Hello, beautiful people, and welcome to Latinx YC, where we discuss all things related to U.S. politics from a Latino, Latina, and Latinx perspective. Hola, Clemencia.
Hola, mi amor, ¿qué más?
¿Cómo estás?
¿Qué hace?
Aquí, esperándote, emocionada de, like, you know, I'm sorry.
Hola, ¿qué hace?
Excited. To have our conversation?
Yes, me too. Hi, everyone. So my name is Clemencia Herrera, and I am the founder of Moyer Studio, little logo right here, an ad agency that specializes in political advertising for Latinos.
Yeah. And I am Cecilia Del Cid, an environmental and social justice practitioner, Latin American, immigrant, and community weaver, also working in communications.
An awesome person.
You too, my love. So tell me,
all right,
what are we doing this week? Where were we last week?
So we're going to be continuing our conversation on systemic assimilation, which we decided that it was sort of icky, but very necessary. And Ceci thinks it's a little less icky than me. We also measured our scales of assimilation in which we are. And I think today we're going to take a deep dive into where all this assimilation came from.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We're going to be thinking or exploring. We're going to lean into our curiosity, mm-hmm. and we're going to just think about where all this might be rooted. Where is it coming from?
Yeah. So, Ceci, what do you think?
Well, I think that many of the things that lead to assimilation are rooted in systems of oppression and power. And what do I mean when I say systems of oppression? Mm-hmm. So I am talking about classism, elitism, racism, for example. What we've been very much in this country going through a lot of like reflection, dismantling work when we talk about racism.
I would like, and let's not forget that there's racism amongst Latinx as well.
Yes,
let's absolutely be real here.
No, absolutely. There is colorism, which is very marked in the Latinx community. There's anti-blackness that is really marked in our Latinx community. There's anti-indigeneity, which is also rooted in racism.
Yeah, that word indio. The word indio, yes, is horrible.
That is supposed to be an insult, right? When we call it, when someone tells you,
I'm so indio.
It's not like saying a pride thing. I'm glad that, you know, this little braid over here, I remember many times.
Whenever I would go swimming, people,
I would braid my hair if I was swimming. People would tell me, you know, you look really ethnic. And I didn't know what that meant.
Oh, I know.
But I think you have
ethnic hair. Ethnic. I'm like, what does that even mean?
Yeah, so like those things, right? Like someone saying, hey, when you, you know, appear this way, you look indigenous. And like, yeah, Guatemalan indigenous women, and not just in Guatemala, braid their long, like their hair, right? It's straight, and it's traditionally to use it braided. I like it. I grew up, for me, it was something that I think it was kind of my mom's love languages, the same way she cooked for us. She braided my hair every night before I went to bed, right? Like, it will grow and it will not be a mess in the morning. Yeah. But those are things, other thing that they tell you a lot, hay que mejorar la raza.
Hay que blanquear la raza.
So when we think about systems of oppression and how we've been engaging in politics in this country, we have to take and put a mirror back and think about why might be aligned in one direction or another, mm-hmm. and why our politics, because everything's politics, everything is political, art is political, music is political,
politics is a system of belief, right? In our system of beliefs, the foundation is all of these things that we grew up with and all of these things that are embedded and programmed into our beings. Yeah. And politics is a system of belief as well.
Yes. So where are our politics rooted into, right? Like if I think that certain people embody better characteristics or bad characteristics based on how they look, then I might be valuing certain individuals different than others, right? If I think that someone who has lighter skin color tends to be, I consider them better looking. You know, like for example, in my country, in Guatemala, I know that people who are blonde tend to be really people dye their hair like blonde a lot, whether that's the best color for you or not.
Yeah. Looks super natural.
When I think of like, oh, what I want to do to my hair, I'm always thinking I want it to look natural, you know? And sometimes, and I use blonde, and it was really damaging. It was just not the best color for me. And for me, it was like the same thing as saying, you know, I would use pink. You know, it went back, I would go back. But I think that when we think like looking blondish, looking towards certain stereotypes,
looking wealthy.
And there is a reason for why, right? If I look at my country, wealthier class, because it comes from generational accumulation of wealth and land and histories of colonialism and imperialism, people tend to be in the lighter side.
Mm-hmm.
The poor people.
Yeah, it's just like when you watch all those Mexican telenovelas. Go to Mexico City and see if anybody looks like that. Nobody looks like that.
Nobody looks like that.
But that is a false representation of Mexican communities.
Yes, and that, you know, the fact that, for example, the movie Roma, or like the first like Mexican actress, Yaritza, being one that is like nominated to like awards and is portraying. And also then, and we talk about this a lot of times, how are like we portrayed in media, right? Like, mm-hmm. what are the roles available for African Americans, for Chinese, for, you know, Latinx? A lot of people are always portrayed as the, you know, jardinero, the maid, the cholo that is, you know, the gang member, the criminal.
The mafioso. So,
yes. Mm-hmm,
the criminal.
You know, so.
Or the sexy
all
lady.
All those things. The sexy lady too, huh? The hypersexualization.
Yeah.
So when we think about those systems of oppression, right? Those are all those things that shape how we perceive the world. And we cannot always see them. It's like the fish cannot see the water. We swim in these waters consistently.
Yeah. Yeah, so as I was saying in the last episode, mm-hmm. I had to step back to realize how assimilated I was and how much I was putting down my own culture. And definitely many of us still need, you know, awakening and a little shake up to see the water, right? And to mm-hmm. see how much of this programming we have inside of our minds and just is centuries of programming. Of course it's gonna be difficult to tear it down, you know?
Learn it.
Yeah.
You know, it took us, and not just that, I think it will be a continuous process until we are no longer here.
Here in the United States?
Here in the earth.
Oh,
like
okay.
Here. If this is not going to...
Like as humans?
Yeah, it's not going to be a point in which you say, like, check.
Yeah, I mean, there's always...
I have dismantled all my oppression.
There's always the thinking that one is better than the other. You know, that like that Bob Marley song, Until the Philosophy, with holds one race superior and another. Not only in race, but in general, you know, I'm richer than this guy. I do better than this guy. My skin color is better than this guy. Or my religion is better than this other guy's. And there's always this like, we need to up one another. And yes, so I agree with you.
And I think biases are just, they're part of human nature, right? Like our brains are coded to fill in the gaps with information we have collected. So, you know, when you are having a conversation, how does my brain know to rely? My brain has certain pathways and relies on certain mechanisms to go and grab information and help me make decisions quickly, right? Mm-hmm. So that I don't have to ponder everything. Having biases is just part of human nature. We mm-hmm. all have them. Like, mm-hmm. I am biased for like handmade tortillas versus machine made tortillas, right? And probably you can be biased for arepas versus a tortilla.
Yeah, and we I might say fail that a tortilla, the blind test.
You know, the tortilla is better, right? Like, I'd be like, an arepa is good if it's stuffed with cheese or something else, but like, I would take my tortilla, right? We all have biases. It's part of our brain process.
And this is really important, because as people look at candidates, they're really looking at them from the lens of a bias.
Yeah.
So, you know, as Latino are being reached out to by a certain candidate or by a certain campaign, there's already that programming that is, mm-hmm. like you mentioned, the bias, and that's the lens that they're looking at them through. So.
So if you're deeply rooted in patriarchy, for example, and you find yourself with a young, vital, brown, black, Asian woman, because there is a lot of Latin Americans or Latinx, Asian American, like Asian intersect, like there is like Nipo Brasileiros, Peru and Ecuador have large populations of Japanese descendants and Chinese descendants. There is a lot in Mexico, and like in Guatemala, there is like Korean immigrants. So Asian, like our race, we said, you know, is our phenotypical way, and our ethnicity is our cultural associations. Mm-hmm. So you can be of any race and be Latino, Latina, Latinx.
And identify yourself, This is why that census question was so hard to answer, right? You know, what do people identify themselves with?
And it's also self-identification, right? So for example, I use myself as an example. I think of myself as a mestiza in the context of Latin America and Guatemala, just saying like I'm mixed race. I definitely, I'm not saying, oh, my parents came from X country in Europe. Like, let's say I'm not like the daughter of German immigrants in Guatemala. No, like my family's been in Guatemala for a long time. I don't know how many, I don't know a lot of my genealogy history, but there is like my mom, and I'm not claiming indigeneity. It's not like I, you know, in Guatemala, indigenous groups have their own attire, their own cultures, their own language. I don't have that.
Yeah. Did you do a 23andMe?
No, I would. There's another conversation, but
okay.
I will not put my DNA out there. That's a whole other issue. I will not put my DNA. It's not regulated well enough for me to like share my DNA with people yet.
Yeah.
But what I was thinking is, so I identify as mestiza and I identify as Guatemalan and Latin American. So I think sometimes people here, and I think you might identify, you know, you can think of this question yourself. If you have, if I had black ancestry, I could be like Afro-Guatemalan, Afro-Latina. I could be Asian Guatemalan, you know, Chinese Guatemalan.
I mean, right? I definitely know that there's some African something, because, like, look at my hair.
But, you know, so I think you're saying the right things, right? Like, when we look at a candidate, and I was saying these women, that I was, like, this hypothetical woman, how many of us think that a woman's role is in leading politically? Or how many of us think, based on that patriarchal thinking, that a woman's role is to be a mother, a wife, a caregiver, other things, not other than a political candidate, right?
Yeah. There's a lot of intersectionality in there.
Yeah, and if you think also of, for example, the political class in your country, how many of the Colombian population are African descendants? Afro-Colombians, for example.
It's a small percentage, I think.
Okay.
Most of them are mestizos.
Okay, but they're black.
Yeah.
There is a large population of black Colombians.
Yeah, depending on the region. But in the north and west coast, yeah.
Let's say that 20% of Colombian citizens are Afro-descendants. Are 20% of the political class of Colombian Afro-descendants? Have you ever seen a black candidate reach power in Colombian politics?
Yes, there have been some, not a lot, but yes, there have been. So, but it does not reflect the percentage of African Colombians, definitely.
And that's what we're trying to say, right? Like, how inclined are we to vote for people who we have been taught that do not embody the qualities, the good, high moral standards that the political leadership is supposed to embody?
Yeah, yeah. And also, this whole thing that we talked about, the system of oppression, which includes like classism, right? You know, how likely are people to vote for someone that is low income or came from, you know, a low income family, or, you know, or someone that is like, you know, well off? So, you know, and this is why, you know, we named this episode Voting for the American Dream. You know, like you're voting in for the people who you aspire to be someday, maybe, and you're looking through it to that bias, like, oh, I think that person is very, I mean, I have heard family members say, oh, you know, Trump just looks so elegant and very good pose, like poise. I'm like, really? We're voting for him because of poise? So, you know, and that's just, you know, I've heard this over by other, you know, about other candidates, you know, good poise and they just well spoken and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, really? That's what we are, you know, going to vote about? Like, is that what matters? And so all of this, you know, just goes back to...
I also want to think about, this is something also we're heard in Guatemala saying that if you vote in people who are already rich, they then don't steal that much because they already have money.
Yes.
So about like class,
they don't need, like, they're not gonna be corrupt.
Poor, if they voted people who are poor or that comes from the working class. But to me it's like, if we are choosing representatives, people who will represent us, wouldn't be that we want someone who understands what it means to live on a minimum wage?
Yeah.
Wouldn't want someone who would understand what it means to have your health, you know, tied up to your employment, for example.
Yeah.
And so if you lose your employment, you lose your health services.
Yeah.
We need someone who understands what it means, you know. Do you think that Trump knows how much a gallon of milk costs? Or how many, how much a family spends in a grocery? Not just him, any of the senators right now.
Yeah.
How many of them come? How many of them have anything in common with the people they are supposed to represent?
Yeah.
I think we have more in Congress. Congress is more diverse, and a lot, most recently, a lot of more people have put themselves forward as representatives, as candidate people of color, women, trans individuals, people with different gender identities. So we have some of these other, but I, you know, when we think about all those things that we're talking, we're still voting through our lens, all those biases that we have learned over generations.
Yeah.
Because we learn a lot of our politics from our family.
Yeah. And you know what? And please tell me what you think, but this is what I think. Coming to the US as a Latino already gives you status, right? It already, you know, puts you in a better position than other Latinos in some people's minds. So, you know, as soon as some Latinos, this is from my own experience, as soon as some Latinos get their passport, they're like, oh, esos indios. For the non-Spanish speakers, indios is a derogatory term that just means indigenous, to just mean someone who is like what, low, not like low intelligence, and very like rude and just uneducated.
It doesn't mean that. It means someone from Las Indias, and that's what that's what they thought they had discovered. Yeah. We were
but over
here.
Time it has developed, and I don't know if this is
very
from
negative
colonial
connotation.
Times, but it is a negative connotation to say that someone is uneducated and rude. So yeah, so they get this passport and they go, ay, esos indios, or the people that have low class, or they in their words, low class, or mm-hmm. people that may be living from government assistance. Oh, it's a chusma. You know, mm-hmm. Excuse me. Some of these people came here, and some of the people were undocumented and eventually, you know, got documents. Mm-hmm. And some of these people, you know, were struggling back home. So they very quickly forget what it is to have been struggling. And this is where, you know, I get like aggravated, you know, sometimes with certain people, in which I just say, can't you just remember back in the day when you were like this? Just because I don't want to invalidate all your hard work and all the sacrifices you've done, because we all have done the same, and I totally appreciate what you've done, but you don't need to put people down. Just because they are still struggling doesn't mean that they're not working as hard as you are. Doesn't mean mm-hmm. that they don't deserve the same that you do. It's not like people are getting things for free. There are certain, and these systems of oppression, in my opinion, are the ones that are keeping people poor, and the ones that are keeping people uneducated. And
absolutely.
Just, yeah. So you might be already starting, like, I don't know, it's like almost like starting a race, and they tie your foot to your arm. And so you have to like jump in this race, you mm-hmm. know, like, it's almost like that.
This is, so a couple of things that you said resonate with me. I think this idea that tells you that poor people are less deserving. So I don't know you, but I don't know any poor person that is not a hard worker. Yep. If you have to struggle for the bare minimum every day. And when I think I've seen it here, and in the United States, it's a little more difficult because poverty is really out of sight. It's worked really hard to be hidden. In our countries, it's more in your face. But if I get into the streets in Guatemala at like 5 a.m., which I try not to do anywhere, ever, because 5 a.m. is, no one should be up.
Nothing good happens after 2 a.m., my parents said.
No, but like, you know, at 5 a.m., people, the poor people in Guatemala are the ones pushing their carts, pushing their little stand, getting their fruit stand set up. Like, those are the ones doing hard labor.
Yeah.
Work at that moment. So I want us to think about these. We have made it a character flaw to be poor.
Yeah.
It's as a personal failure on your part.
Yeah. I mean, like, there was another statistic that I read mm-hmm. a couple of years ago that was really interesting and very sad, that mm-hmm. a quarter of the people that are homeless in the city of Boston mm-hmm. have jobs.
Yes. That is, so that tells us that the system, the capitalist system, is making it impossible for someone to work 40 hours a week and have a dignified life. Yeah. I'm not talking that everyone has to live in a brownstone in downtown Boston. I am saying that everyone has the right to live in a clean home that has water and utilities and has good space outside, like good like trees on the streets, like it's, you know, environmentally safe, that doesn't have lead paint, like to eat. Do not have to make a decision between, do I pay for my car so I can go to work? Do I buy my bus ticket? Do I pay for my rent? Or do I buy food for my children? Mm-hmm. So yeah. If you are working, you should, and some people say, well, it's their fault that they have these jobs. But is it? And do we fund all our schools the right, the same way, at the same level? The way the system is set up right now, it's like the best, the wealthiest neighborhoods have already the best health, like the best public schools, right?
Yeah, because imagine of property
if we invested,
taxes.
If we invested the same amount per each child, let's say we collect all the property taxes in the city of Boston, and then we spent the same amount per child. Imagine that. Imagine what that would mean to invest the same amount of money. So that's what I was saying, like we attach this personal flaw instead of thinking that it's systemic. And also we believe in this, in especially in the United States, this meritocracy, mm-hmm. when pull yourself by your own bootstraps. Some people don't have boots.
And working hard equates to how successful you are. And you know what? As a person of color, I can say that I've worked my butt off. I should probably be a gazillionaire.
But you remember how...
But sometimes we are set up for failure. Sometimes,
you remember how, I think it
no
was
matter how
Obama.
Hard we work, it doesn't compute.
Yeah. You're right. It doesn't compute. And you remember how Obama, I think he mentioned that in one of his many speeches, like, black men had to work twice as good as, do twice as much work to prove themselves.
And all the ladies can.
White men.
All the ladies can relate to this.
No, and
women
have to
work twice as hard to be recognized. And it's the same with people of color and just, yeah.
But I have to say that this is when we think of intersectionality, right? Like a black man is still a man. So he benefits from the systems that privilege, that it's not that they give extra, but they don't put as many hurdles to men.
Right.
And a white woman, while is, is disadvantaged because they're women, they're still racially privileged. So a black or brown woman has two systems of oppression squashing that. And how much extra work we have to do to make sure that we can get to the same place. And what you're saying, it's like if we run a race and there is, I've seen a lot of cartoons, and when you see like everyone ready to like do the 400 meter race, you know how they are all like staggered.
Yeah.
And the at the edge, they're all the men, they're all like in their suits and ready. And then there's other people who have like a laundry machine in front of them, like children, grandparents, like all these other things. You cannot run at the same speed. You cannot accomplish the same amount of things if the system is not set up
for everyone to succeed.
Imagine how, when you look at a traditional family, if you have someone who you can go to work and the other person will do all your house chores, educate your children, plan your meals, clean your house, and then you can go and work.
Yeah, sounds amazing.
But if you had to monetize that.
Also,
if you had to
work
pay someone
from 9 to 5, then, that would be enough.
But think about how, so all these systems are in everything we do every day. And we usually don't think about them because that's just how things are. And that's people tell us, but that's how the world works. And that is not true. We have created these systems. These are social constructs. Mm-hmm. We know that different cultures have different setups.
Yeah.
So we can adjust them and we can look back and think, okay, as a voter, where are my biases?
Mm-hmm.
Why do I prefer to vote? When I look at a candidate, do I look at their platform? Do I look at the work they're doing for my community? How they are going to address my concerns, the concerns of people that have my problems?
Mm-hmm.
Do they even know? If you have never gone through the immigration process, a lot of people tell you, I just wish they did it the right way. And I think you don't think that if there was a way for 11 million people to legalize their situation, their documentation, that they would have not already gotten on that queue?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's not like, they're just lazy and they haven't filled out that paper. It's not that simple. It's not that simple.
And also, the United States has created, through the relationships with Latin American countries, many of the situations that have exacerbated.
Yeah. Yeah, the war on drugs, for example.
War on drugs.
Yeah. War on drugs has ravaged, so many countries, from Bolivia all the way to Mexico, and have caused so much displacement of people, and therefore asylum, refugees. Mm-hmm. There's so many Colombian refugees from the war.
Yes.
Yeah.
So when we think about how all these systems like make you, think of like why, first of all, like why are we here?
Mm-hmm.
we are definitely, we were talking a little bit about the census, and it just came to me to mind that I think that this is the lowest rate, this was the first time the rate of growth of the population of the United States slowed down to compare to the 1930s, I think. Mm. And so there is less immigration, there is less, like the birth rate is lower, so the population growth is, you know, it's not increasing exponentially or in an upgrade. So we know that these potential problems or things that politicians are usually using against many Latinx, because we have become also the face of the immigrants, which is, we're not the only immigrants coming. Yeah. There is,
we're
immigrants for all over the world.
The majority of them.
Well, and historically, right now we are, you know, we're brown. In the past, other immigrants have come from different countries, and they eventually have fitted into the construction of whiteness in this country, because not everyone was white at the beginning. Like Irish weren't white.
Italians are not
white. You know, to me they are. They're European. Why wouldn't they be? So yeah. Those are all things that I want us to just think that have been constructed.
Yeah. You know? No, and that's true. And Europeans, no matter where they're from, many of them identify as white, even if, you know, in certain countries, they're a little bit darker.
Yeah. But that's the thing, right? Like, that's a skin deep. It doesn't change anything about the value of a human life or, like, the dignity,
yeah,
the divinity of that life. We have associated. So
that's it. That's great. You know, it's a great point, because you know what? Many Latinos also identify as white when they're not, but it's really about because they want to feel better about themselves. And it's like, again,
it's proximity to power.
Going back to that assimilation, putting down who you are, putting down your skin color, putting down your language, putting down your ethnicity, putting it down and just say, I'm actually this other thing. And because that gets me to a better place. Or like you said once, gets me closer to power.
Yeah. I think we think of like a spectrum, and white is this phantom imaginary holder of all virtues, and black has all these character flaws, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why colorism affects in Latin America, because we're brown, right? Mm-hmm. So we're not quite as dark as black.
Right.
And think about how difficult, like, when people are dark in our countries. I am very pale right now, but the ability of being lighter skin gives me privilege, gives me opportunities to jobs, that gives me probably better treatment. People in Guatemala even pay attention to your last name being indigenous or not. What it means to have, and like I remember friends being in love and their parents being like, my grandchildren will not have that last name.
Mm. I'm sure some of them changed it too.
but like what I'm saying is that their partner was going to have like indigenous last names. That was not, well, you know, not seen. And people can change that. And people, like indigenous people in Guatemala, are really proud. They are real, like, I think they're more connected to their culture than people who are mixed race are. Mm, we are more in that spectrum. And I think we're also very much always trying to, like, you know, there is a huge market for people to have bleaching creams, for your features to be whitened, so your nose to be sharpened, your lips, even though now lips, like big fat lips are kind of in fashion right now for a long time.
That was booties.
But those have been kind of commercializations of black features.
Yeah.
That then puts them in this like also consumption of black and brown bodies.
Which is also over-sexualized. Right?
Yeah. So that is all, when that, again, that's rooted in capitalism, in how we consume beauty, how we what is sold, you know, sell to us, what products are developed for us.
Yeah, from the, you know, from back in the beginning of entertainment, you know, Africans, or Americans were shows, you know, were like entertainment. They were the dancers, they were the singers, and the women were over-sexualized, and so were the men. So it, it's still pervasive. You still see it. And then Latinas is the same, you know, as we said before, they're also over-sexualized. They're the ones that come on and break up the marriage and they're the lovers, and the men are also the lovers, the Latin lovers. And, you know.
But I think, so, you know, this is a good conversation for us to just, and I'm just keeping an eye on our time and not, you know, trying to keep you all reminder that we will continue having this conversation.
Yeah.
But
we have so much more to say about this.
We have to begin thinking and exploring and not doing it. We're not having this conversation to tell people you're bad.
Right.
We're having this conversation so that as community we can think about what have we done that is being ingrained and how we can like unlearn it.
Yeah,
because right? It's not about
it is
being bad.
It's less about being the victim, because that's one of the consequences of being colonized, you know. We are the ones that lost. We were the ones that were oppressed. We were the ones that have been victimized. But you know what? We're not the victims anymore. This is about responsibility and taking our place and claiming our power. And so this is sort of like a little tickling of like, maybe if you feel something, you know, maybe this offends you, and that's fine. We wanna shake up, because there's some of this, if it offends you, maybe there's something that, you know, maybe we need to look at. And because at the end of the day, this whole thing that we're talking about is because the plan is to divide and conquer. They are trying to divide us in many different ways and put us against each other. And what we're trying to do is sort of like start to untangle all these things that are trying to divide the Latino community, because we are not against each other. We need to come together and fight for each other and support each other as a community.
And I think we have great traditions of doing that. I think that when we think from a scarcity instead of abundance, we fall into that. When we think like, if I have more, that means that Clemencia has to have less. Mm-hmm. Instead of thinking like, I can have a dignified life in which I thrive in it, and Clemencia can also have a dignified life and thrive in it. And it doesn't have to be thought of on dollar signs.
Yes. All right.
All right.
So to be continued, this is awesome. Thank you so much, Ceci. And thanks for all of you who are listening out there. Please leave us a review. Send us an email, clem@latinxyzpod.com. Tell us how you feel. If you hate us, I hope you don't. But if you do, let us know. There's also a Twitter account. More social media stuff is coming up, but there's a Twitter account, LatinxYZPod. And let us know how you feel, and if you like it, or if you have any topics that you want us to, you know, dissect and take a deep dive on. And
thank you very much for inviting me to have these conversations and for sharing all the important details of you, of your experience with me.
Yes. All right. So
see you soon.
Thank you, and see you next week.